Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show on this wonderful leaping year. This is, of course, the fourth leap that we've had at BBS Radio, and tonight's guest is Dr. Colin Ross. I think you're going to enjoy this show. I know a lot of you have been waiting for it. We did a pre-show last week talking about things that I believe in and that Dr. Ross is into. Dr. Ross is an internationally renowned clinician, researcher, author, and lecturer in the field of disassociation and trauma-related disorders. And I think we've had a few of those, including one in Pasadena today in California. He is the founder and president of the Colin A. Ross Institute for Psychological Trauma. He obtained his medical doctor from the University of Alberta in 1981 and completed his training in psychiatry at the University of Manitoba in 1985. He has been running a hospital-based trauma program in Dallas, Texas since 1991. Dr. Ross's book, Trauma Model, A Solution to the Problem of Comorbidity in Psychiatry, was first introduced in 2000, with a second edition appearing in 2007. Other recent books of his include The Schizophrenia, Innovations in Diagnosis and Treatment, 2004. My favorite, The CIA Doctor's Human Rights Violations by American Psychiatrists, 2006. And another one, which I haven't studied yet, Moonshadow, Stories of Trauma and Recovery. In addition, Dr. Ross has authored over 130 professional papers, has reviewed numerous professional journals and grant agencies, and is past president of the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Disassociation. He has appeared in a number of television documentaries and has published essays, aphorisms, poetry, and fiction. And I posted one of his books up on that, too, on the front of our website. He has collections of essays, short stories, photographs, and screenplays in preparation for publication. And the coolest thing about Dr. Ross, he's from Canada, because as a co-owner of BBS Radio, you know, Don and Doug are from Canada. My friend Dan Aykroyd is from Canada. The coolest people come from Canada. So welcome to the show, Dr. Ross. How's it going?
It's going well since I got to listen to that introduction.
Well, that's my intro. I have studied you, like, and I think you're amazing. I think you're doing fantastic work out there.
Thank you.
Yeah. And, of course, you're over in Texas tonight, right?
Yeah, basking in the warmth of Texas.
Yeah. What part of Texas are you located?
My office is actually in Richardson, which is a suburb of Dallas.
Oh, okay. So you could be out there in one of those. There are a lot of soaps done in Dallas, including one called that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So anyway, how did you get into all this stuff? I mean, you've got a really a cross section. Obviously, a Renaissance man. I'm probably looking for your music albums up here next. Do you play music?
No, my son does though.
And, what does he play?
He's a lead singer, guitarist, songwriter in a rock band. My
father
makes a living as a clarinetist. I've got a lot of music in the family. My parents actually met in the choir at McGill University.
That's wild. I sang in a choir in a Presbyterian church when I was a kid at St. John's Church in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, that's pretty close to Toronto where my son lives.
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah.
The height of my singing career was actually in third grade.
Right.
When our class got invited to sing as a class choir on CBC Radio in Winnipeg.
Wow.
But Jim Morrow and I had to stay behind at school with the other class.
That's cool.
Well, we weren't allowed to go and sing because we were so bad.
We'd
ruin the whole class choir.
Yeah, that's funny. It's like me now. My singing isn't what it used to be. I used to be a soprano. Now I get paid not to go in and sing. I get a lot of money by showing up and not singing.
I try to make a living.
Yeah. So how did you get into, you know, your degree? You've got a great degree in psychiatry and medical doctor, and I know you work in three different hospitals around the country. How did you get to this position? What motivated you to get here? And the other question that my audience want to know, how the heck did you get involved as a freedom fighter rebel rouser like the rest of us at BBS?
Well, it's a long story, of course, but I can shorten it down.
Yeah.
I really decided to become a psychiatrist when I was a kid.
Right.
I was just really interested in how the mind works, and I was interested in medicine as well. And so then that's basically been my plan since literally fourth grade.
Wow.
And then one of the further I got into the educational system, getting like a ninth grade, I was in trouble at school and bored with school. And ended up being a high school dropout in the end.
Okay.
So I was a high school dropout. My dad worked for Esso, which is Canadian branch of Mobil.
Yeah, there used to be Esso stations down here.
Well, we retreated north of the border at some point, I guess.
Yeah.
And so I got transferred to England with my family, and then when they came back to Canada, I stayed there for a while, and that was my illustrious career as a high school dropout from there up into the Canadian Arctic. And then I ended up going to college in 1975 when I was 25, and I finished high school just a couple of months before that by correspondence.
So you're like Einstein. You were a late bloomer.
Well, I was thinking, reading, studying all the way through, mostly literature, anthropology, philosophy, history, and still had psychiatry in the back of my mind. Then I finally decided, okay, I got to get back into the academic groove here. So then I went down to the University of Alberta and ended up getting into medical school.
Where'd you go? So you got out of school, and then how'd you get involved in the hospitals and stuff?
Well, that's just kind of a natural one. I finished medical school in 81, then I went over back to Winnipeg where I'd grown up, my 4 years of psychiatry, and it's all hospital-based.
Okay.
And then I was an academic psychiatrist in Winnipeg, full-time kind of university professor type guy. And then in 91, I ended up moving down to Dallas and got recruited. I came down to talk at a conference and then ended up getting recruited to come work here.
Okay.
And then just been based at a private hospital in Dallas ever since. The one I was at initially is closed now, so I jumped to another one. And then that hospital is part of a corporation, and I opened a second program in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah, I'm from Ann Arbor, by the way. So you're in my backyard there.
Yeah, it's not far. It's just a couple hours drive.
Yeah.
So the hospital in Grand Rapids is owned by the same corporation, and then I kind of inherited a pre-existing program in Los Angeles. So I got those three programs that I consult in.
That's really nice. That keeps your chops up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Do you notice a difference, a differentiation in those three different hospitals and the types of problems that the patients have that you have to see, or is there a similarity in all of them? You know, sort of like based on the environment where these people live, like the East Coast.
They all have regional or national draws.
Yeah, okay.
Like half the people in the Dallas program are from outside Texas.
Yeah.
And the program philosophy is the same at each place, so it's pretty much the same group of people.
So you don't see a local area psychosis going on, Michigan versus Torrance, California, for example.
Well, in California, everybody's psychotic.
So yeah, I know. At least I noticed in Texas you haven't picked up the Texas draw yet, you know.
No, I'm working on that still.
You're working on that?
I'm a slow
You need to
study.
See George Bush. He needs to come and see you, doesn't he?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he's really motivated.
Yeah. He's definitely a New World Order kind of guy.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
So, anyhow, we were talking earlier, and one of my pet peeves, and my listeners know this, is these SSRI drugs, reuptake inhibitors, being basically some form of angel dust, and that's kind of what you and I were talking about this afternoon, and that's kind of where I'd like to lead in with somebody with your credentials and get your opinions and what you and the FDA have discussed, because you've told me some of the opinions of the FDA about these kinds of things.
Okay. Well, just so everybody in the audience is clear, the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist is a psychologist does a BA and then an MA and then a PhD, studies more research methods, probably does more experiments, and they do lab experiments, rat experiments, experiments with people and so on. But they don't go to medical school, so they can't prescribe medications, can't admit people to the hospital. A psychiatrist goes to medical school, and then after medical school does psychiatry. So psychiatrists know a little bit more about biochemicals and how the body works and all that kind of stuff.
A lot more, I would say.
Right. So then I have kind of a reasonable understanding of how drugs work and receptors and the brain and neurotransmitters and all that kind of stuff. And when I went into psychiatry, I wasn't really interested in trauma really at all, because nobody was talking about it or writing about it. And then right away I noticed, wait a minute, everybody in the wards of the hospital has been abused or had some horrible events or losses, or just a tidal wave of trauma, abuse, loss, death, neglect, chaos, family violence. But none of my teachers and none of the textbooks were really talking about it. And then in medical school, I, on my own, diagnosed somebody with multiple personality. And that's how I got into trauma, abuse, multiple personality. They're all connected together.
Which was a big thing in MK Ultra, and that's another subject we can get to, in creating multiple, like the Manchurian, I call it the Manchurian Candidate phenomenon.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my CIA doctor's book is based on about 15,000 pages of CIA documents. They're all actually declassified in the 70s, plus a whole raft of papers that I went and photocopied at the medical school from about 1950 to 1975. And the Manchurian Candidate, which is an artificial multiple personality created for use in operations, that's absolutely documented fact, not fiction. And I believe those people are still being used operationally to the present.
Do you think George Bush had some of that indoctrination, do you think? Because I know he had a drug problem.
Possible, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not impossible.
Yeah. He is a strange character. So anyhow, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, so in the course of all of that, I learned about medications and antidepressants and antipsychotics and the basic kind of propaganda I got from the field of psychiatry as a whole and my teachers was we've really made huge strides in the last few decades. We're understanding that these are brain diseases and they're chemical imbalances and doesn't have anything to do with how your parents treated you. And we've got these powerful, effective medications that have really revolutionized psychiatry. And now we're, you know, really becoming a solid branch of medicine. That was the propaganda, which actually is not, in fact, scientifically true. So it took me, you know, a whole period of years and thinking and reading and studying and reading between the lines and criticizing to figure out that if you take the antidepressants, which are kind of the old ones, and the new ones. The new ones are mostly the SSRIs.
Right.
Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Right.
So they work on the, they're called selective because they pretty well just focus in on the serotonin system. And they give your serotonin system a boost, which fits with the idea that there's something low in your serotonin system, that's why you're depressed, and then we just boost it up back to normal levels and we've got you balanced out again and you're okay. That's the story.
That's what it says on the paper.
Yeah. But actually, when you look at the data before the most recent rounds of analysis, if you look at, this is in psychiatry journals. This is not, you know, some radical, you know, journal out there somewhere. Mainstream,
right,
leading psychiatry journals. When they put together a whole bunch of antidepressant studies, the definition of being a responder is on a depression measure, your score drops by 50% or more. And the standard one's called the Hamilton Depression Scale. So let's say you score 36 at the beginning of the study. If you're below 18 at the end of the study, you're, quotes, a responder.
Okay, once you've taken the medications.
Yeah, this is
right.
Usually 6 or 8 weeks on medication.
Okay.
You're either on placebo or on medication. And you don't know which, and the doctor doesn't know which.
Really? That's
interesting. In these studies that are done to get the drugs approved by the FDA.
Okay.
So overall, 50% of people respond to the medication, the antidepressant medication, and 30% respond to placebo. Those are the basic facts in the psychiatry literature. So these medications are not powerful and effective, and they're only just a hair better than placebo.
Right.
But what we found out now through Freedom of Information Act requests and people really pounding on the doors of the FDA is that the drug companies suppressed a lot of studies where there was no difference between drug and placebo.
Ah.
So what they do is they do a whole bunch of studies and then pool them all together, kick out the ones that aren't in favor of the drug, and that results in this gap between drug and placebo. But when you uncover all of that and you dump all the studies back in, this is just, it's available on the Internet. You can find it easily on the Internet. So when you analyze all the studies, including the ones that the drug company suppressed, for mild or moderate depression, it's an exact tie between drug and placebo. And there's only a little difference between drug and placebo for the people who are severely depressed. And the reason for that is not because the drugs work better there, it's because the placebo effect starts to drop off.
Okay.
So for most people, who are on these antidepressants, they scientifically, for a fact, are absolutely no different from placebo. But that doesn't fit with the propaganda that you hear on the television when there's drug ads on the television, that you hear from the drug companies, or that you hear from the profession of psychiatry.
Okay, now let's talk about for a second, Stephen Kaczmarek in Illinois a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
who was on Paxil. Now, they claim, he got crazy when they took him off of it. Now, do you think that drug was working on him at all, or do you think that the ingredients in the drug had a side effect when he started to detox and the ingredients somehow or other, broke down in the system to cause him to become like that, or do you think he was going to do that anyway? What was your read on that?
Well, all of the above are possible.
Yeah, okay.
And I've never met the guy, so I don't know for a fact.
Yeah, I don't know how much. Yeah, okay.
And now he's dead. But
yeah.
here's the way it actually works in reality.
Yeah.
Because you could come off as sounding like kind of a little bit out there conspiracy nut if you say, I think the antidepressant caused him or Columbine shooters or Virginia Tech shooter, or whoever it might be, to kill those people.
Right.
That's going to sound a little out there.
Yeah, no, it doesn't to me.
It doesn't to you, but to a lot of people it would just be a rubber.
Yeah.
There's no way. But the thing is, that's actually the official position of the government of the United States through the FDA. The FDA recently reanalyzed, a couple of years ago, all of the drug studies for people up to 18, and then they actually extended it up to age 24 recently. And so they insisted that the drug companies have to put what's called a black box warning on all the insert, which is the sheet of paper that lists all the side effects and everything that's inside the prescription box.
Right.
So a black box warning has got a big black border around it, and it says in people up to age 24, compared to placebo, these medications increase suicidal and homicidal thinking and behavior.
Interesting. Up till age 24.
Yeah.
What do you think about Britney Spears right now? Do you think she's got some kind of bipolar disorder? Just jumping into, look how she's behaving.
Well, first of all, the bipolar diagnosis is way overdiagnosed by psychiatrists these days.
Okay. Interesting.
It's almost like when I'm joking about this at a workshop, which is not really that funny.
Yeah.
I'll say I'm kind of leading all the therapists on because it's all master's level and PhD therapists in the audience.
Yeah.
I'm saying, well, we've recently discovered the cause of bipolar mood disorder. We know for scientific fact what causes it. And they're looking at me kind of skeptically. Oh, I haven't heard that. What's this?
Yeah.
And I say, yeah, we've learned that it's actually an infectious disease. And now they're going, infectious disease. And I say, yeah, you catch it by just driving towards a psychiatrist's office.
Yeah, I love it.
They all roll their eyes.
Yeah.
But the point being, it's way overdiagnosed these days. So whether it's Britney Spears or somebody else, when I hear they have that diagnosis, I go, could be accurate, could be totally bogus.
Yeah.
I just can't rely on it.
Yeah, I know, I've worked with some people. I've seen people, what I would call bipolar, but they have an incredible switch in personalities. They almost are Manchurian candidates. And I've seen it in women more than I have men, believe it or not.
Britney Spears on television, she's in her car with that pink wig on.
Right, I remember that.
Looking out the window, talking in a British accent, saying that she doesn't know who they're talking about. She's never met this person. And they're talking about that paparazzi guy she's been dating for the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And then when the wig is off, she doesn't remember talking in a British accent.
Wow.
That's on, Entertainment Tonight.
Wow.
So, obviously, she's got some problems and needs some help. That's all I know about her for sure.
Yeah. Well, I know that you probably get a quick read on people when you see them, even in the news, if you see them enough. So anyway, you think that all the above on the Paxil, and that's the same thing with
Prozac, Effexor, all these things. There's two ways it can work. One is that the medication has toxic side effects.
Right.
You can end up with your sexuality really locked down and suppressed, and that can last for months and months and months and months after you come off the drug. So these things really knock down your sex drive.
Yeah.
One toxic side effect. But they also cause agitation, delirium, hallucinations, suicidal, homicidal thinking, and behavior when you get into a toxic state. And that can be on a regular dose. And people die. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of cases of people burning themselves to death, hanging themselves, shooting themselves, who were not suicidal until they got on the drug.
Right. I've seen a few of those cases, for sure.
They're horrible cases. And so it's absolutely scientifically known and a fact, according to the FDA, that this is true. And so if you're just thinking to yourself, oh, well, these medications can cause, especially people up to age 24, to become violent, homicidal, suicidal, and you're thinking to yourself, gee, I wonder where I could go collect up some cases like that. The first place you'd want to go is to people who became violent, homicidal, and suicidal. And then when you go to the school shooters, case after case after case after case, these guys have been on antidepressants.
Oh, I've got a list of like 25 of them right in front of me here. And the drug list is a mile long, but it's the same drugs, basically.
Yeah, same group of drugs.
And yeah, same group.
So then, of course, the position of the drug companies and psychiatry is, well, they had mental health problems, including depression, that caused them to do the shooting, and the antidepressants were trying to treat the problem. So it's blamed on the problem, not on the antidepressants. But that doesn't fit with what the FDA says and what we know to be scientifically true.
Yeah, explain what the FDA says. And this is a real interesting thing. It appears, this is my take on this, Big Pharma, the drug companies, are starting to run roughshod over the FDA now.
Oh,
I mean, it never used to be that way, I don't think, but it definitely, it does, you know, it's like when we look at the, when Don Rumsfeld was the big shareholder in, was it Roche or one of the big labs, and they did the thing on aspartame and the toxic side effects from that. They had horrible results in their studies, and they just told the FDA, take a hike. We're putting aspartame on the market.
Yeah. Aspartame you're talking about.
Yeah, aspartame, yeah.
Which is in Diet Colas. You know, I'm just starting to look into that a bit myself. Some people have gotten me interested in that.
Yeah.
It's exactly like you say. There was data suppressed, data distorted. The manufacturers of aspartame would say stuff like, we've tested it extensively in animals and found it to be safe.
Yeah.
And then when you actually dig out the data, it's like they tested it on 7 rats and 4 of the rats died.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, not kidding around. That's actually what the data were.
No, I know. I've seen some of that. That's my point. So it appears that, you know, I totally think this country is going into a fascist state, you know, with the creation of, in 1913, of Federal Reserve Board, who are just a private bunch of bankers with the power to print money, you know, for the government, and then take our income taxes and pay their interest on it, because the government spends it, all the way up to where corporations got involved. Now I think Big Pharma is highly controllable of this country's future. I mean, it's unfortunate, but, I mean, it's almost scary if you really start looking at the facts, and I'm
definitely.
Sure you've seen some of this stuff.
Well, definitely, and we already have a proven track record of this being a fact, except it was the tobacco industry. I mean, they said, no health effects from tobacco for years when they had their own data proved all the problems that tobacco causes.
Yeah.
And so there's no reason that drug companies are more or less holy than tobacco companies.
Yeah, it's for some strange reason. And, you know, you didn't have a lot of shootings and killings on tobacco. You got a lot of cancer, which is another industry, but we didn't see people smoking a cigarette and going and shooting somebody, you know.
Well, when I was in medical school, I was actually in medical school just before AIDS hit, so we didn't have a lot of AIDS cases.
Right.
And you go to medical school the first couple of years, you sit in all these lectures, and you're just dying to get out in the wards and see some real cases. You hear all this high-tech stuff and memorize all these obscure diseases and so on. And then you go on the wards, and you find, like in general internal medicine, majority of the people didn't take their insulin properly, so their diabetes is out of control.
Right.
Drank heavily, smoke heavily, didn't exercise, were overweight.
Right.
And they've got strokes, you know, heart disease, lung cancer. And so every medical student sees dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of deaths from tobacco and alcohol.
Right.
And nobody ever sees a single side effect, complication, bad reaction, or medical problem from marijuana. Not one.
Right.
And yet, the teaching you get in medical school, of course, is marijuana is the gateway drug, the great horror, it's criminal.
Right.
It damages your lungs if you smoke it. But meanwhile, we've got this huge level of tolerance for alcohol and tobacco.
Yeah.
So all these social attitudes don't fit with the medical facts at all.
No, I totally agree. I've always been I'm not a big marijuana user, but I've always been an advocate of it because I've seen it calm a lot of people down, and I've seen it, I think it's awesome out here in California that people that have cancer and that and can't eat.
Right.
Don't have cancer after a while, if they get to eat and do the kind. I have a guy that worked for me. He works for me currently. He had, 6-8 weeks to live. I took him on as a holistic, because I do holistic work, got him on a remission on cancer. Then he went down and got his little, he was way underweight, and he went down and got himself a marijuana license, to smoke this stuff.
Right.
Started smoking it. I fattened him up. He started eating. And the guy's one of my best employees now, and he's normal weight, and he was going to die in 6 weeks, But I just, it was his choice to use the marijuana. I didn't recommend it, but it worked for him, It made him eat again.
Forget the exact number. I think it's 42,000 motor vehicle accident deaths in the U.S. per year.
Yeah.
Somewhere in around there, of which 50% are alcohol-related.
Yeah, I believe that.
When you look at the statistics, there's not even a category for marijuana-related.
No, I don't know of any accidents caused on it. I think the people that smoke it are smart enough to stay home anyway. Why drive around and smoke this stuff?
Right.
Probably ruins their high,
Probably.
Yeah. Now
you might get caught.
So. Yeah. Now I have a question for you. Looking at the key ingredients, and we talk about it on my show from time to time. Most of these reuptake inhibiting drugs are cyclohexene, cyclohexane, both. If you type those in on the internet, are highly toxic, and then piperidine, methyl piperidine, in the case of Paxil.
You're talking about the core chemical structure of it.
Yeah. Now, back years ago, I did an internship as a as a naturopath with a medical doctor over in Santa Monica, and he did a drug rehab for people strung out on freebase cocaine, angel dust, and heroin, and I learned a lot about what angel dust does to people. And what it did to people, in some cases, there's people that drink alcohol and they become happy, and then there's people that drink alcohol and become psychotic.
Right.
But what I saw on most people smoking angel dust or snorting it, most people became psychotic.
Right.
And then with alcohol, they became dangerous,
Bad combination.
And that's why I always say that these three ingredients that I see in all these drugs, seems to me, over a period of time, are going to have a destructive effect on their psyche and personal, and their character and everything,
Well, the antipsychotic drugs, there's some newer ones that don't have this side effect quite so much, but we've just traded that for another side effect. But when I was in my residency, with the old ones, they had what are called extrapyramidal side effects.
Okay, and what are those?
It means it, sort of like Parkinson's disease, it makes your muscles stiff, and makes you have shakes and have a kind of shuffling, stiff-looking gait.
Okay.
And sometimes your muscles kind of seize up, and you'll get, like, your wry neck with your head twisted over, or your tongue will get all garbled up. And there's a... Usually that'll go away if you stop the medication.
Oh, okay.
But about 20% of people on these medications long-term develop what's called tardive dyskinesia, which is where you have abnormal jerking, twitching movements that last either for years... once you stop the drug, or the rest of your life.
Wow, that's serious.
So we knew for an absolute fact that these drugs damaged your brain. That's damage to the part of your brain that runs your motor system.
Wow.
So these are not just theories that these drugs damage the brain. These are absolute facts.
Now, when as a doctor, as a prescriber, do you get any pressure put on you especially as a psychiatrist, medical doctor, do you get pressure put on you by these drug manufacturers to prescribe, or do they send you samples and say, here, use them? What happens there?
Well, I personally have had a policy of not talking to drug reps for over 20 years. I just refuse to talk to them.
And they
my
don't
private
talk?
Practice now is so tiny that they don't want to bother with me anyway. It's not worth their effort.
So what are you doing mostly now, lectures and things
do
like that?
I do therapy in the 5 times a week in my programs, and then, yeah, writing, teaching, lecturing.
Yeah, well, I know you and I have only recently met, and I would love, as we were talking about earlier, to get you out to the some of these conventions where I speak and some people like me. I think you would be very welcomed
by the
American public to get out and get down with the people. I think they're waiting for somebody like you with your credentials.
By the way, speaking of angel dust,
yeah,
do you know how angel dust first got on the streets in North America?
Well, I have my idea. I could hear how you would describe it.
For a fact,
yeah.
Documented, not a theory.
Okay.
CIA and military-sponsored mind-control experimentation.
Right.
Exactly the same as LSD.
Okay.
Do you know who the first major, you may already know, but do you know who the first major supplier and manufacturer of LSD in North America was?
No.
Because normally you'd think, well, beatniks, mafia, Colombians, somebody.
Yeah.
The history of it is that LSD was discovered really by accident by a chemist in Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Switzerland,
right.
Albert Hoffman. Albert Hoffman,
right.
He was working on rye fungus derivatives. And
right.
He got some LSD, sort of switched the chemical a little bit, and by accident invented LSD, got it on his fingertip, licked it, and went on the world's first acid trip.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah. Good day for Albert. So then... Sandoz then was the only manufacturer and supplier of LSD in the world. And the KGB and the CIA and all kinds of other people were studying it for interrogation and mind control, erasing memories, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And this is according to CIA documents that I have. The CIA was concerned that the Soviet Union, and then the memos, they used to call them the Soviet back in the 50s, was going to buy up the entire world supply of LSD. And so
that's interesting.
They decided they needed a secure North American supply. So in 1953, under MKUltra, that you're familiar with, they, at top secret clearance level, contracted with Eli Lilly Company for $400,000, a lot of money in 1953.
Yeah, that was. It would be about $40 million today, almost.
To manufacture LSD. So the first major manufacturer and distributor of LSD in North America was Eli Lilly Company.
Interesting.
And the first major buyer was the government of the United States.
Wow.
And then Ken Kesey.
Yeah, I remember him. I actually met him once.
Allen Ginsberg. All these guys got turned on first by military-supplied LSD.
That I didn't know.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. My first exposure to phencyclidine was back in 1959, I'd been working at the University of Michigan as a kid. My dad was very famous. He brought the London Bridge over,
yeah,
and I was born.
And he
worked for Henry Ford, who was a big money supplier to University of Michigan. So I was born in the hospital there, delivered by Henry Ford's personal physician, Norman Miller.
Hmm.
So I had the spoon in my mouth as far as science goes. And there was another kid that I worked with. His name was Stephen Eberbaugh, and his dad owned Eberbaugh Pharmacy. He, in 52, which was before that, he brought us a transistor from Sony in Japan. So we were putting electrodes on the occipital parietal lobes with a little generator that we had. We built our own oscilloscope, and we were doing hypnosis by electronic induction. That's how I got involved with MKUltra.
And
we had, in those days, they wanted kids that were a little bit above average, and because there was a big Soviet Iron Curtain threat, and there was a shortage of scientists, blah, 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 and they were grooming us.
Mm-hmm.
So to make a long story short, my mother moved from Ann Arbor, and I was working there at the University of Michigan. I was studying there while I was in high school. I got down into Arkansas, and I was in the 11th grade, and the CIA came in. And they said, we're taking you into the military. And I thought that was cool. I didn't want to be in Arkansas. I missed Michigan. So off I went. Well, part of my billeting process, they took me down to Little Rock, and they put me up in a motel and for a little while. And I was being babysitted or taken care of by a bunch of scientists over at the bioweapons facility at the Army base in Little Rock. And that's, these guys were homosexual, and I'm not against that, but I mean, I'm just bringing this up, and they were doing angel dust. They had it there because it was part of a bioweapons thing. That's how, and that was in 1960, I believe. That was my first, I didn't do any of it, but I saw it, you know what I mean? That, so I knew it had something to do with the military, and that was my beginning of that's how it came. It was never an elephant tranquilizer. I knew that, you know?
Right.
But that was the disinformation campaign was the elephant tranquilizer thing when it got to the street level, you know?
Right. It spilled out, though, from the CIA and the military. They were the people who first had it, developed it, were taking it, studying it. And then a broader web of psychiatrists started taking it and using it. Then they started running experiments, and then it kind of moved into the civilian sector of psychiatry.
Yeah.
And psychiatrists were doing non-military stuff with trying to treat alcoholism and trying to treat all kinds of stuff with LSD, and then started turning on more and more of their friends, and then it just spilled out of the public. And when it got too out of control or too out in the public, that's when it was flipped over to be a dangerous drug and
went on the number one list. That was probably back during, but right after Haight-Ashbury, when it got really popular up in San Francisco.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate your credibility, your credentials, verifying pretty much my story, because a lot of people still think it's animal tranquilizer. I says no, I don't think an elephant ever had it. There was ketamine, which was, I guess, a derivative of it.
It's a kind of similar drug, which is used as a tranquilizer.
Yeah, and that came much, much, much later. It was liquid, and it was injected.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was much later. Well, it's interesting to have you on the show, because you've got a pretty good background in this stuff, too, you know? I mean,
well,
I've
got all these documents and spent a lot of time reading them and piecing them all together. And in my book, I made a point. Like, I like all kinds of, you know, government conspiracy stuff. I find it very interesting and intriguing.
Yeah.
But for this book, I decided I'm just going to stick 100% with documented facts.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the documented facts are absolutely astounding.
Yeah.
More astounding than fiction.
Well, one thing I'd like to talk about now, if you don't mind switching a little bit, is your CIA book and these sub programs. You know, one of the things you brought up back in 1933, explain to the people how private sector suddenly started doing the government's dirty work, starting with that case in 1933, I think you quoted in your book or something. That's very interesting, because a lot of people think this was all done by the government in some lab somewhere or some prison, when in fact hospitals all over the country had been doing this stuff, paid for by the government.
Well, if you just look at, like, when I was in my psychiatry training, I never heard or anything about any of this stuff.
Right.
And I came down to Dallas in 91, and then patients started telling me stories about how they were involved in experiments like this. And I thought, no, that's really stretching it a bit, but I'm going to look into this.
Right.
Then I started looking into it and found more and more and more and more and more facts. And so cleared at top secret clearance level, contractors on MKUltra, MKSearch, Artichoke, Bluebird, included Harvard, UCLA, Yale, University of Minnesota. You just go down the list, all the major institutions and a lot of the kind of second-tier universities. And if you look through the leading contractors cleared at top secret in psychiatry, they tend to be past presidents of the American Psychiatric Association, people who've received awards from the American Psychiatric Association, editors of leading psychiatry journals. So it's not some kind of like obscure mad scientist in a basement somewhere. This mind control experimentation was contracted out throughout academia, the leading medical schools, leading universities, leading psychiatrists. It was very systematic. And there was just kind of this old boy network that kept it under wraps and kept it quiet, all of which is completely proven by all these documents.
Yeah, I think the one you cite is the Tuskegee syphilis study. That was one study that I noticed in your notes,
The reason I talked about that is, it's one of those things that you would just think is absolutely impossible, no way.
Yeah.
And so I stumbled onto a book about it, read about it, and then got some background papers and so on. So the Tuskegee syphilis study ran from the 36, I think it was, somewhere in around 1936 up to 1972.
Wow, I didn't know. Yeah, 25 years, yeah.
And at the 25-year mark of the study,
yeah,
all the guys in the study got a certificate, and they got a $25, $1 for every year of participation.
Wow.
And the certificate was signed by the Surgeon General. And what it was they took these 400 guys in really poor, uneducated, rural black guys who all had syphilis, and they followed them up for 40 years total in the study, just about, and blocked any attempts to give them any kind of treatment for their syphilis.
Wow.
Even all the way through the antibiotic era. And
wow.
So then what was the purpose of the study? To find out what happens to people when they have untreated syphilis. And then they had another 400 guys who didn't have syphilis who
yeah.
were at the controls, and they followed them. And so lo and behold, what did they find out? They found out that if you don't treat syphilis, people get sick and die early.
Yeah.
It was a completely useless, stupid study. And there had already been a study done exactly the same in Norway back in the around the First World War. So I thought, oh, well, how do they keep that secret? And then I read the book and I went and got the papers. I have a photocopy of a paper published in a leading medical journal in 1965. The title of the paper is Untreated Syphilis in the Male Negro.
Wow.
So this is outrageous when you think about it. And obviously they weren't doing this with the sons and daughters of senators or, you know, Harvard professors. They're doing it with black guys in Alabama. But hold on. For 40 years, 400 black guys had untreated syphilis. So how many women did they infect?
Oh, yeah,
good
point.
How many babies were born with congenital syphilis because of this research? And this research was signed off on and approved by the U.S. Public Health Service, American Heart Association, various state medical societies, the Surgeon General, published in mainstream medical journals. So if something that outrageous can happen in public, what do you think is going on in psychiatry with mind control experimentation?
Exactly. And that was a long time ago.
But this Tuskegee syphilis study ran up until 1972, and it was only shut down because a journalist in the Bay Area caught wind of it and made a big fuss about it and went public with it.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, there's another one that I want to bring up, and that's, you know, this has to do with that spy that died. He was injected, and I guess you call it, you know, it's called the Boston Project, where people are injected with uranium. It seems to me that was a way they got rid of people rather quickly, too.
Are you talking about Olson now?
No, the Boston Project was run jointly by the Massachusetts General Hospital and the Health Physics Division of Oak Ridge National Laboratory.
Oh, right.
William Sweet, that
right,
guy,
right, William
Sweet.
Sweet,
yeah.
Yeah, he's in my book. William Sweet is interesting because he cross-links two things. He was a neurosurgeon at Harvard.
Okay.
And he was involved in the brain electrode implant team.
Okay, interesting.
So there was one brain electrode implant team at Harvard, one at Yale, and one at Tulane. And the main guy at Yale was funded by the Office of Naval Research. The main guy at Tulane was funded by all three branches of the military plus the CIA. And the guys at Harvard talked to and had equipment supplied to them by the guy at Yale. And they have a... let's see, it's the 70s, I guess, the book was published. They have a book and a series of papers, and they show a 16-year-old girl who's had an electrode implanted in her brain.
Wow.
And the guy at Yale developed this transmitter. So at first it was kind of primitive, so you had this port sticking out of the person's skull, and you attached electrodes to the port, and then
right.
the wires actually physically ran over to the stimulator machine. But this guy at Yale, Jose Delgado,
Yeah, he's another one I heard about, yeah.
He was, I'll get to him in a second, but he developed a technology where you could seal the scalp over and you could stimulate the electrode remotely with a radio transmitter. And what he shows is a photograph of this girl. Now, this girl was not being treated. This is purely experimental, 16-year-old girl. In one picture, she's staring there with this blank grin on her face. Another one, she's strumming her guitar, and another one, she's pounding the wall furiously. All that behavior totally controlled by which button he's pushing on his radio transmitter.
That's amazing.
And this guy, Jose Delgado, when he did these experiments on cats, he called them mechanical toys.
Right.
And he did them on human beings, a kid as young as 11 years old. And he wrote a book where his dream for the future was, we're going to control the entire population, we, this little group of doctors and politicians and military people and so on, we're going to pop electrodes in the brains of every single person in the country and control them all. This is a book published by a mainstream New York publisher. This is his dream for the future. This is where these guys were trying to go.
Yeah, I agree. And when you start getting into the satellite technology that we have, which I know people in that quite well, because I used to be, before I got into what I'm doing now, I worked at NASA as a rocket scientist.
Right.
That's taking it to the next level. And then, of course, we come to the situation of implants, like the chip they want to put in everybody now.
Well,
what do you think?
The UCLA violence project in the 70s was shut down by public protest. It was approved and funded by Ronald Reagan.
Right.
The lead guy on it was a psychiatrist named Louis Jolyon West.
Right.
Who was a top secret cleared contractor for CIA, NSA, all branches of the military, who worked on mentor and candidate programs.
Wow.
All documented. And is well known for killing an elephant at Oklahoma City Zoo with a huge dose of LSD.
Wow.
And also, other claims to fame of this guy include, he was called in to assess Jack Ruby and determined that Jack Ruby shot Oswald while having an epileptic seizure, which is obviously a completely bogus cover story.
Yeah.
And he was also the first guy called in to see Timothy McVeigh at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. He was previously chairman of Department of Psychiatry in Oklahoma.
Wow.
And just in the Dallas Morning News, there was, as soon as McVeigh was captured, there was a little thing in the Dallas Morning News, an Associated Press article, saying that McVeigh claimed that the first thing that happened after he was picked up was he was taken to Tinker Air Force Base and a computer chip was removed from his buttock.
Really?
Put in him during the Gulf War.
Wow.
So anyway, this guy, Jolly West, was involved in all kinds of different levels of this, that, and the other, including the mentoring candidate programs.
Now, is this stuff in your new book? Because I haven't read your book yet. I've just read an overview of it.
Book,
is this in
that
CI book, or where is this information? Because I want to read this, because I'm working on a book called The Inside Track, and I want to quote you, if you don't mind. I want to plagiarize you a little bit.
Yeah, it's all in my book.
With your permission.
CIA.
Yeah, it's in that new book?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that book, I originally published that in the year 2000 with the title Bluebird.
Yeah.
Because the Bluebird program was one of the first CIA mind control programs.
Yeah.
But then I decided nobody's really going to know what that book's about.
Yeah.
So the CIA Doctors is basically exactly the same book, just with a different title.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. Because, first of all, I want my audience to know we're going to be carrying all of these books we're talking about. Some of his information, you know, Dr. Ross's information is going to be in my new book, The Inside Track. And give out your, some of these people out there are listening are on their cell phones and that, and they don't have a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Give out your information where they can buy these books and a couple of the titles that are appropriate. And I don't know if you want to put any phone numbers out for phone calls after the show or sometime during the week, but if you want to do that, do it, and if you don't, you know.
It's better to email. So,
okay, yeah, put out your email then.
Just go to Amazon.com and enter and click on books and enter Colin Ross. All my books will come up. Or you can go to my webpage, which is www.rossinst.com, which is short for Ross Institute. Or if you just do a Google search under Colin A. Ross, MD, my webpage will come up. And my email address and all my contact information is on my webpage. Plus all my books are there.
Yeah. How many books have you written anyway?
15, but I've got another 5 coming out shortly.
Could you tell me, I've only written about 3. How in the heck do you find time to write books with the integrity that I see that is in your books? What kind of discipline do you have? I mean, what drug are you on to do these books with all the stuff you do?
The drug of life.
Yeah.
But, I've been writing them going back. The first book I published was in my 20s.
Okay.
So I didn't, just do this in 3 years.
Okay.
And I'm publishing 5 books shortly.
Yeah.
Through my own publishing company.
Right.
But there, several of them are collected essays back from going, actually back to the 60s, mostly the 70s and early 80s. So a lot of it I've written over, you know, spaced out over 20, 25 years. But I really like writing, and I keep my clinical work down to a small enough level that I keep my hand in and I stay fresh, but I've got a lot of time for writing, reading, thinking.
Yeah. Because you, I mean, I've done the inside cover search on your books, and I want everybody to know we're going to be carrying his books out there, a lot of them here will be available too, because we, you know, we're going to put you up on our website, and, you know, you have your flow of people coming through, and we have ours, and what happens is we want to really spread the word around of the work that you're doing into our groups, and I have a huge following of probably 100 million worldwide because I've done a lot of radio shows for 20 years. But I really, really respect the fact that you came on the program, you know, and are sharing all this with us. And you actually, you know, people thought I was nuts. I think you're giving me some counseling here, you know, as to the fact that what I believe in, you've actually, you know, factually produced in your writings and your studies. And it's really great to have people like you, you know, on this planet.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, we could maybe form a nice partnership in the future. It'd be good.
Yeah, I really want to have you on our show. I'm going to be talking to the folks over at the Art Bell Show. They're friends of mine that run that. And I've already mentioned...
You're not related to him?
No, Art's cousin. But Art's crazy. He's a ham operator. We're friends. But he's not doing a whole lot right now. I'm working more with George Norrie and Ian Punnett.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to Lisa the other day, Lyon, who runs the show, and she didn't know who you were. I said, Lisa, I said, you got to be kidding. This guy should be all over Art Bell, you know. And I'm going to make sure you get on the show, you know.
All right.
Yeah, this will be good. And then I'd love to have you on as a regular on this show, you know. So we only got about 2 or 3 minutes left. Is there any other topics that you'd like to go through? We've covered a lot of stuff here in the last, you know, almost hour.
I write all kinds of stuff, poetry and fiction and short stories and plays and so on. One play that I got a little ways into it now, I'm writing, is called Project Virginia Tech. And so I've set it up as it's the first opening scene is just a few days after the Virginia Tech shooting.
Right.
And what's happened is the director of operations of the CIA has called a task force together to look into what's going on with the Virginia Tech shooter. So there's several guys from the CIA and a guy from the state and a guy from FBI and a guy from Virginia Campus Police who's the sort of novice who doesn't have a high clearance level, who doesn't really know what's going on, and he's just learning. And he's kind of the skeptic non-believer. And the task force is charged to figure out whether Cho is just mentally ill, it was a toxic reaction to a drug, whether he was a mentoring candidate of the United States or if he was being handled and operated by a hostile intelligence agency. And these people seriously consider all of these possibilities and look into them.
Wow.
That's the reason being for writing the play is, besides I like writing plays, is these are all actual possibilities.
No, they are. I mean, they totally are.
And there's a bunch of, for Cho in particular, with a lot of these other guys, there's no particular evidence, but with Cho, there's quite a lot of circumstantial evidence in the public domain, on the mainstream television, mainstream newspapers, supporting the idea that he had multiple personality.
Yeah, I believe that. I didn't do a big study on him like I did with the Columbine case, because I was up there, you know, with Al Gore and Janet Reno.
Mm-hmm.
But this one was, you know, later, and it sounds like you've done your due diligence on it. And I totally agree that what you're saying is all possible.
And the thing is, it's all just public domain information that you can easily get on the Internet.
Yeah.
Nothing, no inside track on anything.
Yeah.
So the purpose of the play, besides to entertain, is to get people to think about, wow, that's actually possible.
Yeah, it totally is. It totally is. And have you exposed your screenplays to anybody over in Hollywood yet?
Actually, I just have some people looking at it currently. I've got some very, kind of by luck, interesting people looking at them. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, if that can help you out. I've been involved with the Hollywood scene for a long time. If you need any help, let me know, and I'll be glad to.
More help, the better.
Yeah. The more help, the better. I agree totally.
Because you can't educate people by just being an academic psychiatrist publishing in psychiatry journals. It's just impossible.
No. No, it doesn't work that way, unfortunately. But what's his name that did the X-File? Chris Carter. I had a connection with him, and this would be almost a Chris Carter movie, you know.
Oh, it's totally a Chris Carter.
Yeah,
movie.
And yeah. So I got a friend of mine that's coming back. He's doing a thing, taking a bunch of people down to Peru right now on one of these exploratory things. And when he gets back, I'm going to present
something?
A bunch of your stuff, you know, to him.
I actually consulted them on one show, the X-File. They
did you?
A nice show where a woman had multiple personality. They did a good job.
Well, that's good. We'll talk off air later on next week, and because I need to know some of that stuff because I really want to do some things with you. I mean, you're really a very enlightened person in all of this, and it's a lonely world out there when you know all the things that we know.
I'm the only. There's one other psychiatrist who wrote a book about CIA mind control because
yeah.
his dad was a victim of mind control in Montreal.
Wow.
But he really just focused on his dad and the other people in that case. So I'm literally the only psychiatrist in the world who's written in public a broad look at all of this mind control experimentation.
Yeah, I believe that. And on top of that, a lot of these guys are afraid that they'll lose their credentials if they do it. You ventured out and you've gone quite a ways, you know.
Yeah. I just made a decision to do it and not to be paranoid about it.
Okay, well, we're out of time. We've had Dr. Ross. It was a pleasure having you on the program.
Good.
We could have
pleasure
gone 2 hours with this one. And I've got to sign off because the next person's coming on.
Okay.
But anyhow, this is Dr. Fred Bell signing off. A minute late, but we run over sometimes. And we've had Dr. Colin Ross on. We'll leave that posted on the BBS radio. And we look forward to having him back on our show. And thank you for making this the number one show on BBS radio. Good night. Bye.